right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really happy to have you back listening to a very full and a very hard-hitting show today. All right, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a frequent guest on the show. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. She's a founder of the site StopPatriarchy.org, and she sits on the national board of World Can't Wait. And Sansara is going to be talking with us about the horrible rapes in India and the U.S. and the assault against abortion in the U.S., what they have in common, where they come from, what they have in common, and why everybody needs to stand up and say no more. All right, but before we get into that, I'm very pleased to be presenting on the show today part two of the five-part interview with Bob Avakian that I did just a little while ago. Now, we debuted the interview last week with part one. This is part two, and we'll have three more parts after this, all right? So stay tuned as we go along. You don't want to miss this interview. If you're somebody who can see how the world is really screwed up and your heart really aches for fundamental change, you ache for some kind of revolution, and you're trying to figure out, how can this happen? What can we do to stop all this? You know, well, this interview is going to knock your socks off, all right? There's nothing else like this out there. And today's interview gets into the strategy for revolution, you know, why it's not crazy to be thinking about revolution, and what's the importance of winning, not just talking about revolution, but actually the importance of winning. So without any further ado, let's jump right into the interview now. Okay, well, I want to move in from where we've just been talking to talk about the solution to all this. I want to talk about revolution. And I want to open it up by reading from chapter 3, number 1 of Basics, in the chapter called Making Revolution. And I think it's important for people to hear this. And I do, you know, I know I've heard you talk before about the importance of Basics and it being a handbook for revolution. And I want to get into that a little bit later as we talk about all this. But let's read this. Let's get down to basics. We need a revolution. Anything else in the final analysis is bull. Now, that doesn't mean we don't unite with people in all sorts of struggles short of revolution. We definitely need to do that. But the proffering of any other solution to these monumental and monstrous problems and outrages is ridiculous, frankly. And we need to be taking the offensive and mobilizing increasing numbers of masses to cut through this shit and bring to the fore what really is the solution to this. And to answer the questions and, yes, the accusations that come forth in response to this, while deepening our scientific basis for being able to do this. And the point is, not only do we need to be doing this, but we need to be bringing forward, unleashing, and leading, and enabling increasing numbers of the masses to do this. They need to be inspired not just with a general idea of revolution, but with a deepening understanding and a scientific grounding as to why and how revolution really is the answer to all this. All right, so listening to that, I have to say that while especially being part of the Basics bus tour this summer, there is this deep yearning and searching from many people in society for a way out of this mess, and from a significant section of the society. But there's also, overall, if you start to talk about something like this, there's really a sentiment out there and an understanding of, one, how difficult this is, but also the idea that to really seriously talk about making a revolution in a place like this is a little crazy. What do you say to that?
Well, I can understand why people say that, because it is, you know, you are talking about making revolution against the force in the world that is the most powerful oppressive force in the world. And so, you know, it's easy to see why people would think, you know, especially, you know, if they haven't really dug into the question, but just looking at it, you know, sort of on the most obvious level on the surface, it would seem to be crazy. It would seem to be impossible. But I think when you dig more deeply, you come to see that the same reasons why this system is not reformable, that it operates according to certain, it has a certain nature, it operates according to certain rules, if you will, or certain dynamics. You know, it's a system based on exploiting literally hundreds of millions and billions of people in this whole network of sweatshops and other exploitive conditions around the world, and including very intensely in the third world, that it is a system based on the rivalry between different capitalists and big groupings of capitalists and big financial institutions and corporations battling each other to accumulate in rivalry with each other the wealth that is produced through this exploitation and through the actual work of ultimately millions and millions of people. That, in other words, the private appropriation of socially produced wealth, to put it that way, that this is a system that you cannot cause this system to operate according to different rules and dynamics and the ones that are at the base of and which characterize the whole way in which the system functions. That's why, for example, just to take something we haven't yet touched on, but which is a very important thing and something that a lot of people are concerned about, and there needs to be a lot more concern and a lot more action around it, the environment. There has been conference after conference after conference, meeting after meeting after meeting, agreement after agreement after agreement, or conferences that reach no agreement, in which all these major powers in the world and the rulers of the different capitalist countries have pledged to do something to lower the emissions, to do things that would address the increasing ruination of the environment, and yet it just continues and gets worse and escalates and is even more rapidly assuming the proportions of a serious emergency on even a greater scale and more rapidly than even those people who've been actively concerned about it and predicting that it would reach dire consequences had predicted a few years ago. So, you know, all the attempts to have agreements, and even agreements that have been reached to try to do something about the environment, have led to nothing and have been broken and violated because of these basic dynamics of the system. If you don't go plunder the oil from Alaska, then some other rival capitalist grouping will do so. So you have to do it. And, you know, the same thing goes for other ways in which the environment is being despoiled. So this is a system that has brought us to the situation where not only through its wars and its the mass arsenals that are in the hands of these imperialist rulers of the U.S., but other countries as well, but also through the workings of their system and its effect on the environment, we are getting to a very, you know, this is all reaching very serious and, yes, literally emergency proportions. And this is something that many people are becoming increasingly aware of. There are people who are beginning to act around it. There is even a spontaneous understanding that this can't be solved just within one country, that it's something that you have to take in the whole world, that it's an international problem. Now, there's still a lot of hope and illusion that somehow you can convince the rulers of this country, including by putting pressure on them through mass protests, to act more rationally. But that is running up against the fact that they cannot do so even if they want to, for the reasons that I basically touched on and sketched. So this is a kind of situation where potentially a lot of people who otherwise might be more complacent, if not actively complicit, with what's going on in this society and other crimes being committed by the imperialists might come into motion around, and are coming in some measure into motion around. And this is just one example of the workings of this system and the way it forces people to rise up against it. And also, even its normal functioning is continually disrupted by the very dynamics of the system. So there's constantly these jolts and disruptions of the normal functioning of the system, and constantly ways in which people under those circumstances raise their heads and question and even resist what they normally and all too often accept. I mean, I've given the example of Trayvon Martin and the murder of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. And I've made the point that a lot of people, most people who became aware of that, and including most people who became active around it, didn't even know who Trayvon Martin was. And then all of a sudden, because his family refused to simply put up with this murder and to allow it, the outrage of it, to be buried, it finally broke through. People in society learned about it, and it resonated with many, many people because it concentrates so much about the whole history of this country and how it's dealt with and how it's treated and the horrible oppression it's brought down on black people. And so a lot of people who never even heard of Trayvon Martin a month ago were not only speaking out but actually acting in opposition to this and an outrage over it. Now, of course, that didn't lead. It didn't keep going in a straight line forward. It didn't lead to a revolution. But these are the kinds of things where the operation of the system creates these kind of jolts and shocks that cause people to raise their heads and, as I said, question and even resist what they normally and all too often accept. And you can go down the line with other things that happen. Even, you know, there was an important article on our website, revcom.us, by Raymond Lotta, speaking to how in the context and in relation to the recent storm Sandy in the East Coast, as the title of the article says, why a natural disaster became a social disaster and why it doesn't have to be that way. Reflections on Sandy and on the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal which our party has published. And this article goes into the ways in which exactly what the title suggests happened. That this was a natural disaster. It wasn't that the imperialists decided, let's have a terrible storm and cause people to suffer. But the way in which they did and did not deal with that. The priorities they had in keeping with the whole way in which their system functions and has to be ruled caused much greater and much additional suffering than would have otherwise happened and needed to happen, and that would have happened if you had a radically different socialist system and economy and government that put very different priorities, including in anticipating and preparing for such a storm, as well as in the way it was responded to once it happened. And I think I would really recommend that people go on the website, rempcom.us, and look into that article, because it does a very, you know, it is very living in the way it sketches out why the ruling class of this country, in that case in New York City and other places, but from the president on down as well, dealt with this the way they did what they did and did not do what they did not do, and how this could be and would be dealt with in a radically different way with a socialist system, as is embodied and is prefigured in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, which our party has published. So that's just one example. And you can think of many other things. Katrina, for example. Katrina was another natural disaster that became a social disaster on an even greater scale, or at least a more horrific scale. There are many ways in which ordinary people, including in the middle class, but especially poor people, have been suffering terribly and unnecessarily in the conditions of the Sandy storm. But there were even more acute ways in which this happened in Katrina and New Orleans, particularly with the black people and the way they were herded like animals and the way people eat there. You know, as it happened on Rikers Island in New York, but even worse in the prisons of New Orleans, were basically left to die, you know, or to fend for themselves and desperately in order not to die, and so on and so on and so on. The point being that here once again you had a natural disaster which wasn't a plot of the system and the ruling class. It was an act of nature. But the way in which the system did and did not respond to it revealed something about the basic oppressive relations and the basic nature, dynamics, functioning, and priorities of the system and those who preside over it. And it brought to light, for example, a lot of people said in the context of Katrina, look at all these poor black people in New Orleans. I thought we had had the civil rights movement. I thought we had overcome and gotten beyond these kind of conditions. What kind of a country is this? And people all over the world were saying this. I thought America had done something about this. What kind of country do you have there where all these hundreds of thousands of poor black people in New Orleans and the surrounding areas are being, and they're being treated in this kind of way? Well, none of that in and of itself leads to a revolution, but it is the kind of event where forces and factors come together that provide a real jolt into the workings of the system and a jolt to people and cause them to raise their heads and think about this.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian a little while ago, and this section of the interview is on the strategy for revolution. It's part two of a five-part interview.
Now, none of this in and of itself, no particular event like this, or no combination even of events like this, or others we could think of, are going to lead to a fundamental change in society, and certainly not to a revolution which actually overturns and breaks the hold of the ruling class over society and over the people and brings into being a radically different system with radically different institutions that actually represent the interests of the broad masses of people in moving to do away with these oppressive relations. None of that is going to happen just as a result of these events, nor just as a result of the many protests that do take place. I mean, there have been the Occupy protests. There were, you know, in the early 2000s, there were protests against the Iraq War on a fairly big scale. So it's not like there has been no protest, but none of those things by themselves, and even in combination with these jolts to the system of the kind I've been talking about, you know, either the sudden onslaught of the economic crisis that hit in 2007, 2008, and of course is even much more severe in countries like Spain or even further in Greece. None of that in and of itself is going to lead to a revolution. It doesn't cause the ruling class to fall apart, and it doesn't cause the people in and of itself to become conscious of the need not only to resist in powerful ways, but actually to rise up all the way and to seek the leadership that can lead them to fight thoroughly through and make a revolution and actually break the hold of this ruling class over the masses of people and over society and prevent them from continuing to enforce the system that does cause all this. That requires both dramatic changes in the what we could call the objective conditions, the situation that people are faced with, in an even more dramatic and thoroughgoing way than we presently have. It requires, in response to that dramatic and fundamental change in the situation, a real crisis on the part of the people who rule a society, including much further intensification of the rivalry among them. And it requires a revolutionary movement to have been built over a whole period of time leading up to that, with a conscious, disciplined communist core, which is basing itself on a scientific approach, on the communist outlook and method, on the new synthesis of communism, which has been brought forward through the work that I've been doing over several decades, and is embodied in that body of work and in the whole method that infuses that body of work. You need that kind of leadership, and you need the development of a whole movement of revolution that begins where it can begin, with smaller numbers of people, and moves from and grows from a movement of hundreds here and hundreds there to thousands, who are in turn more and more consciously working to influence broader numbers of people in society, not only people at the base who are catching the hardest hell, but people throughout different sections of society, including people among the professions, people in the middle class broadly, certainly the students, people in academia, in the arts, and so on and so forth, and who are preparing in a more and more conscious way and getting organized on a more and more conscious basis to be able to lead those millions that they're influencing when you do get a deep enough crisis, and when, as one of the signs of a developing revolutionary situation, the legitimacy of the system and the legitimacy of those who rule in the system, including their whole electoral process, and the legitimacy of their violence, their organized violence to suppress attempts to resist them and to fight back against their system, when the legitimacy of all that begins to be stripped away and begins to be questioned in a serious way by not just hundreds or thousands, but millions and even tens of millions of people, then if you have that force of thousands and thousands that's been growing and more consciously taking up the task of building a movement for revolution, then you can have a real chance to actually fight all the way through and rally the necessary forces to take on the repressive force that will be brought down on you, and actually find and develop the means to fight through and defeat it and actually make a revolution and break their hold over society and bring into being a radically different society. What I'm sketching out here is it presented in a concentrated way in a statement by our party on the strategy for revolution. And we also have published another statement on the possibility of revolution, which goes further in elaborating the basic theory and strategic conception and approach to how you would actually fight and win in the conditions where you did, to be very clear, not the conditions that exist now, but radically, qualitatively different conditions where you did actually have a revolutionary crisis of a deep kind that I'm talking about, and where the attempts of the ruling class to resolve the crisis and to carry out repression in fact deepened the crisis and brought more and more people to lose this belief in the legitimacy and the permanent necessity of the system and to turn radically against it and to be willing to sacrifice to bring that system down. That then in that situation, and with the leadership that people need to fight in that situation, on the possibility of revolution speaks to the basic strategic conception of how the revolutionary forces could fight with a real prospect of winning under those circumstances. So it may seem crazy if you just look on the surface, but this is something which, like every other aspect of seriously investigating reality and changing reality, has to be approached in a scientific way, and that's what we are seeking to do.
You're listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And this section of the interview is on the strategy for revolution.
You know, it's a trip, because actually when you were talking about this, I kept thinking about, and especially as you were winding up around that, I kept thinking about, again, we started off talking about the weight of the belief in the permanent necessity of the existing conditions. And one of the things that actually even being able to have that strategy, to have this kind of thinking going into things now, that is critically important in terms of being able to help people to break out of the confines that's been set on the box that's been set on their head. you know, around what's possible and can you actually do this? And then it is the point, as I'm listening to you, you know, and it's not like I haven't read the statement of strategy, but as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, okay, this question of, is it crazy? First of all, the way you posed it, the point about it actually comes out like it's crazier to think that it's okay to live in a world that's doing all this, you know? And then when you get through this, it really, the point about how important this kind of work, even in developing these things and then implementing it, I keep thinking back to the interview you did with Abe Brooks about the importance of winning. That's really important in terms of being able, in terms of people being able to break out of this confines, you know, of it's just, we can't do any better than what we're stuck in now. I think this whole point about the importance of winning, and this, what you're saying, adds a lot of weight to that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point that I made in an interview with A. Brooks, which has been published as What Humanity Needs, Revolution and the New Synthesis of Communism, and is accessible at revcom.us, that the whole point of the, you know, of talking about winning is that if you don't actually win, if you don't actually make a revolution, then the world is going to continue on as it is with all the horrors and that are all too much what characterize life for the great majority of humanity. You know, sometimes you can get very narrow and think about only your own immediate circumstances, and especially, once again, if you're among the more privileged strata in this country, you can more or less consciously or even unconsciously close your eyes to what life is like for the great majority of people in the world. But it is an actual fact that for the great majority of humanity under this system, life is a continual horror full of degradation, oppression, and unnecessary suffering. And that is what will continue or even get worse. And then you add into that what's happening with the environment and where that could lead a genuine catastrophe. That is what is going to continue and even get worse if we do not fight through and actually make a revolution. And when it comes down to it, as On the Possibility of Revolution is speaking to, actually fight, if the fight is not carried through to actually win. Otherwise, you know, all you're doing is talking about change. And talking about it is very important, let's be clear, because there's all too little talk about radical change and revolution. There needs to be a lot more talk, but we also need people to be acting on that. We need people to be actively working to build this movement for revolution. We need people to be actively involved in things like the two mass initiatives that our party has been part of launching, around and against mass incarceration and everything bound up with that, all the police brutality, the discrimination, the stop and frisk, and the whole humiliation that goes along with this, you know, the phenomenon of mass incarceration on the one hand. On the other hand, the degradation and oppression of women through pornography, through all the different forms of patriarchal oppression, including the assaults, the mounting assaults on the right to abortion and even birth control. These are two mass initiatives that are both mobilizing people around terrible outrages of this system that no one should be putting up with, but also is mobilizing people around these things which are terrible outrages but are also basic fault lines of this whole system. To put it another way, they are things that they are forms of oppression that are fundamental and essential to this system, and without which it can't do, which it must maintain and continue to enforce, even if particular ways in which that happens change over time, or particular forms may change. This basic oppression of women and the degradation of women and the oppression of black people and others, which has been fundamental to this country from the beginning and is now taking the form, as Michelle Alexander termed it, of the new Jim Crow, embodied in the mass incarceration and everything bound up with that, the brutality, the murder, the harassment, and all the rest of it. These things are fundamental to the system, and building a mass struggle around them is both important in its own right and should unite many people who are determined that these outrages should not continue, even if they are not yet convinced of the need for revolution, while at the same time our party, which is based on the scientific understanding that these and other outrages of the system can only be eliminated with a revolution, needs to both unite with other people in fighting against these things, but also bring that perspective of how this fits into the whole nature and functioning of the system and how it is a crucial part of why we need a revolution and how fighting against this is a crucial part of how we can actually build for a revolution. This is all a very important part of how we're approaching the building of a movement for revolution.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And this section of the interview, it's part two of a five-part interview. This section is on, hey, it's not crazy to be thinking about revolution and to be hoping for revolution. In fact, there's a strategy for revolution, and there's an importance to taking that up and taking it up in a way to win.
Also, going back to what we started with, this and what you were just referring to, this point about the permanent necessity and people having their sights and dreams lowered and narrowed to where all they can see is the confines of this system and striving for some kind of paltry and, frankly, let's be honest, pitiful change within the confines of this system, which is all that's possible if we're going to be real. You know, that to speak to that, and to raise people's sights above that, it is important that we very, you know, enthusiastically and in the right sense aggressively promote the possibility of revolution, the alternative of socialism aiming ultimately for a communist world, which means the end of any form of exploitation and oppression anywhere in the world. It's very important that while we're fighting around other particular outrages, that we bring to people an understanding that a radical alternative is not only needed and desirable, but is possible. This is why we give such importance to our newspaper, Revolution, and to its website, revcom.us, because it does constantly expose the hideous features of this system, but also shows people how all these different features and all the different outrages that occur in society and the world all are interconnected and rooted in the same system, and brings forward the alternative that revolution is what we need to be aiming and building for very concretely and organizing for and raising people's consciousness to, and that communism should be the ultimate goal of this, and we need the science of communism at the core and leadership of this. And one of the forms in which we're now popularizing this is what we call the BA Everywhere campaign, which is whose goal is to spread the new synthesis of communism, the revolution leading toward communism, and the leadership we have for that revolution out into society broadly, not with the expectation that everybody's going to immediately agree to this, because we know we're very aware of the prejudices and misconceptions that have been hammered into people over decades now, which I spoke to earlier, the relentless ideological revenge, which is the correct way to see it, the relentless ideological revenge that's been taken on revolution and communism by the ruling class of this country and its ideological mouthpieces and hitmen and so-called philosophers and political proponents and so on and so forth. So we know that boldly putting this out energetically and in the right sense, aggressively and actively taking this out and fighting for it, is not going to instantly win over millions or even thousands or tens of thousands of people in one bold stroke. But it is, and the goal is, the potential is and the goal is that by doing this and really being bold in this and raising massive funds to really get this out in big and creative ways so it has an impact in the whole society, the point is that this will put this poll out there and be something that people will more and more seriously recognize as something they should be engaging and actually debating and getting into deeply and seeing does in fact this represent the radical alternative. Is it in fact a viable alternative? Is it not only desirable, but is it possible to have this socialist society on the road to communism? Is it actually possible to make a revolution? This is what we're aiming to do by raising funds and by finding creative ways to continue to get this message of revolution and the new synthesis of communism and the leadership that we have for this revolution out in this society and with impact in the world as a whole, because it's not just in this country that a revolution is needed, and it's not just in this country that the new synthesis of communism needs to be fought for. It's an important need in the world as a whole. This revolution ultimately has to be a revolution of the people of the whole world. It has to be an international revolution which won't conquer the whole world all at once. It won't win everywhere all at once. But we have to see the basic orientation and goal as to eventually emancipate all of humanity by making this revolution wave after wave throughout the entire world. So that's what we're seeking to do with this BA Everywhere campaign, is to get this whole pole of communism and its new synthesis out there and the need for and the viability and desirability of revolution out there as something for people to seriously engage and debate and get into in a significant way.
All right, you've been listening to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back a little while ago. And the interview is a five-part interview. You've just listened to part two of the five parts. If you've missed the first part or you miss any part of this interview, you can access it at the KPFK archives or at revcom.us. That's revcom.us, revcom.us.